Okay, so today we're going to be talking continuing through chapter 2. We're going to start out talking about a problem called rotating imbalance. So you have rotating machinery, which is a lot of things that can contribute to vibration in your system and cause lots of problems, actually. So we need to learn how to characterize that vibration, and then we'll learn in chapter 4 one way to get rid of it, actually. We should get to later today also how we might be able to measure vibration. I haven't talked really about that at all in terms of how do you physically measure vibration of a real system. So we'll talk about the structure of those sensors, and then very likely get to talking a little bit about friction, which we've kind of assumed friction doesn't exist thus far this semester. We'll talk about friction and its effects on loss, on vibration. Okay. Before we move down that path, any questions I might be able to answer for you guys? Yes, sir.
Is there a way to see what we've been making like on our homework?
So you've had one homework, right? So if you made a reasonable effort on the problems, then you got a 10, right? That's kind of how I graded out. I'll get those back to you. But basically, if you made a reasonable effort, if you're at least in the ballpark, you got to pass on that problem, and then you can add up what percentage of pass fails for your problems, and then there you go. So, again, I want those homeworks. Those are for you guys, right? I'm not trying to make that a significant contribution to your grade unless you don't do it. So that's a bit of a philosophy change from what you're probably used to in our earlier parts of our curriculum. Right, so one place where Dr. Hibbler and I disagree quite a bit, actually. So on education philosophy, not I don't dislike him as a person or anything. Right. So he's a pretty good guy. All right, let's talk about rotating imbalance. Well, actually, any other questions? Sorry. Okay, so we're going to push through what's probably the remainder of the main theory parts of chapter 2. We'll be back on Thursday and work some example problems. Okay, but even these problems, even the theory part we're going to talk today, we'll connect it back to what we've been doing. You see some of the same theory ideas popping up again, so these can kind of serve as example problems for that too. Okay, so rotating imbalance is section 2.9. We're going to talk about a system that looks something like this one. So we're going to have kind of what looks something like a well, maybe, that's fixed. All around. We're going to have a mass inside this structure. Okay. The surface it's sliding in is frictionless, so we'll draw our little wheels to keep that going. Okay, it is connected to ground at the bottom with spring of spring constant K. And a linear viscous damper, damping coefficient C. I'm going to call this guy, put him in the corner out of the way, M1. The center of M1, we have a secondary system. It's actually doing the rotating. So that's our center, kind of a perfect pen. I'm going to have a mass, M2. At a distance of E. E stands for eccentricity there. Okay. We're going to describe the vertical position from equilibrium of M1, that center point, as X. And then the rotation this guy is kind of positive theta that way. And we typically, in this case, we're not really going to deal with theta as much as we're going to deal with that velocity. So the positive omega is counterclockwise in this case. Okay. So what we have is this system, right, this mass, we have this rotating piece here. So this guy is rotating. He's being driven at some constant angular velocity, omega. Okay. What's going to happen here? It's going to vibrate, yeah. That's why we're talking about it, yeah. Anybody ever had an unbalanced wheel or tire on your car? This is that, basically. All right, so you have a rotating piece of machinery, in that case, a tire on your car. You have some mass. Its center of mass is not at its center of rotation. All right, so even though we've drawn this as a point mass, this could be a big wheel, and this is kind of how representative of how far off from center its center of mass is. Okay? And that's usually the bigger case, right? You have some big rotating piece of machinery, rotating something, right? Some gear train or something maybe, right? If it's unbalanced, the effects of that imbalance are going to drive this thing to start oscillating. Okay. See this a lot in factories. So we do a lot of work, extensive work, to try to isolate machinery from the factory environment. Right? So you don't want a piece of machinery that's vibrating, pushing on the floor over here, and then some really precise piece of machinery down the line from it. But that's going to vibrate the floor. The floor is now vibrating. It's going to screw you up way down the line. So this is kind of a common problem. It makes sense. That's why we're talking about it. So what we want to know is relative to, and I'll put omega here, that angular velocity, our input velocity, right? What's the vibration of this main mass? That's what we need to figure out. Okay, and then how does that vibration, we look at the frequency response of that, right? Not just the time response. So how does the speed at which angular velocity of this rotating imbalance affect the amplitude of the vibration here? Okay. That's what we're trying to get to. So everybody got the problem set up at least? Okay, so how do we get to that information? Yeah, we're going to need, all that stuff comes from the equations of motion. Right? So we're going to need a free body diagram. Okay. There's one body. I'll draw that one a little bigger so we can get the arrows and such in there. Two bodies. What kind of forces do we have? Gravity, sure, we can draw that on. So we have acting at the center of mass. So this, well, I'm going to draw gravity up here, even though we know it's acting at the center of mass. M1g there. Spring force. Damping force. Yeah, so we have some constraints that are keeping it from going through those walls. I'm just going to call those RR and RL, maybe. Constraint forces, right and left. What else do we have? Some kind of reaction to the pin, right? So let's say, as it's rotating, call that N. Largely to match the notation in the book. And we'll call this guy P. Okay. What else do we have? So if there's, imagine there's some kind of motor to this thing that's driving it this way, what is it doing to this mass? It's doing it, driving it the other way, right? So there's some kind of actually reaction moment there from this guy being spun. It's that whole equal and opposite thing. Okay. So that's our main mass, M1. Is that everything there? I think so, right? What about the rotating mass? What kind of forces do we have on it? We have the equal and opposite part of this, right? So we can go NPM. Anything else on that second mass? Yeah, gravity acts on it as well. Anything else? That's it. Okay, what's next? Here's your clue. What's next? Yeah, pick some coordinate frame. What makes sense here? Something, or maybe an origin at the center, yeah? So we have some rotation in this direction. So we'd like to have some axis perpendicular to that. Right? So we can do xy, xy. Right? Then both of those right-hand rules are going to give us a positive, omegas and thetas in the positive direction. Right? Let's try something a little different. X to y gives me a positive omega. Right? And then we have x in the x direction. All right. So let's start writing equations of motion. Let's start with a big mass. Okay. So we know m1 times some kind of acceleration of body 1. We have any motion in this y direction? No. So we can really simplify this down by, hey, just consider everything in the I direction. As we said, it's constrained to move vertically. It's constrained to move that direction already. So that's just like taking this whole equation, vector equation, and just all I care about is the vertical direction. And that's all that dot product does. So we can write maybe the sum of the forces in the x direction. M1, what's the mass's acceleration in that direction? X double dot. Okay. What forces do we have acting in that direction? We have damper, gravity. I'm going to leave that one over here. We'll talk about that in a second. What else? Yeah, that reaction force is in that odd direction. Okay. What's the spring force in this case? Kx, right? X, if we're saying, hey, x is from equilibrium, any deflection of x is, any change in x is just a deflection of the spring. Same thing for the damper, right? So we can write then there we have an equation of motion for the first body. And we don't yet know what n is. All right, so I'll write that so we can find it later. So really what I'm interested in is what is x doing? Right? That's what we said. Hey, this guy is spinning. X really tells me about the vibration that I'm concerned about, the body. Right? So what we want to do is kind of think about this problem and say, well, what of the motion of this M2 body is actually causing motion in X? So what, in that case, actually causes motion in the X direction? Yeah, we just have that N, that reaction which we're calling N. So this reaction is really what's kind of coupling these two systems in the vertical direction. Right, that, just that pin connection. And you can see that here, we need to figure out what N is. It shows up over here. So if we're going to do that, we have to look at the equations of motion for this second mass system, this rotating system. Right. So, and we can do kind of play the same trick. Hey, just look in that vertical direction. We know, hey, N is strictly in that vertical direction. So we can look at maybe the sum of the forces. I'm really only interested in what's in that vertical direction. That's the only motion I'm really worried about right now. Okay. Well, let's just write I'm going to call that, in this case, just AX, acceleration in that X direction of that second mass. Well, what are the forces on this mass in the vertical direction? So we have and the way we've drawn that. So we can write an equation of motion then. The second mass. There are two equations of motion now, right? Well, that doesn't really help us so far. Still, nothing here tells me what N is going to be. Let's talk first, however, about these gravity terms. Okay. Given how we define the system, what can I do with those? Yeah, I can just ignore them here. Right? So I said, hey, I'm measuring X from its equilibrium place. Right, so any motion of X, I can, you know, and we did for a very simple mass spring, very beginning of class, right, looked at, I can describe the system about its equilibrium and gravity just kind of drops out. Because we have the constant part of the spring force balances to constant gravity. They don't really affect the vibration around that equilibrium. Right? And we can do the same argument about M2. So really we can look at, these guys are going to simplify, we can ignore those gravitational effects. So if we look at this right equation, hey, if I figure out what the acceleration of that second mass is as a function of my rotation speed, omega, I should be able to figure out what my response of X is as a function of that rotation speed. Right? Everybody see that? So let's look at what AX is then, right? So we want to know we want to figure out what that AX is. And we want to figure it out as a function of omega, the input, the rotational velocity. How do we do that? Dynamics, yeah. That's what we're doing. Actually, here, I guess it's dynamics. It's a part of that. Yeah.
I have a question. I'm like trying to like picture the system.
Yep.
And so suppose mass 2 was like vertical, and like if you would like let the system go, the box would drop. But as it starts spinning, wouldn't it be opposite? Wouldn't the reaction force be opposite of the weight as it spins?
So it depends. So if this is spinning at speed,
right?
What does that mass want to do? Fly out, right? So that pin force is holding that guy. There's actually a force this direction, and we just broke it into components. It's preventing it from flying away. Right. So if the force on this is holding it in, the force here, this is wanting to pull the thing up the opposite direction.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So
yeah.
But the mass is down, but in reality, it won't go up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't think of any of these as constant, right? This direction, right? The magnitude of this can go to zero. It could be negative.
Okay.
Right. Same thing with P in reality. Yeah, those magnitudes are changing all the time. Mm-hmm. Right, the dynamic. Okay, so what I'm going to say is, hey, right? Let's write that. Where O is the origin of that system, which we said was, hey, fixed at the equilibrium position for that mass. Okay. So, what is that position? It's an E here. So, eccentricity. So, we have this is a length. Cosine of that's in the I direction, right? Angle theta, we're saying, hey, that's actually a function of the rotational velocity and time. Right, so it's cosine theta, it's also, which is equivalent to omega t. Velocity times time is distance. That works in rotation, too. Okay. I think there's something else as part of this guy, if we're thinking about the I direction. XY is fixed. Right, what's the mass doing relative to x? This frame XY. It's moving up and down according to X, right? So this is pinned to X, not pinned to the origin of the frame. Right? So if we're going to get the total displacement of mass 2 relative to the fixed frame, it also includes the vertical deflection of the mass to which the second one is pinned. Of course, we could also describe position in the J direction. Okay. Probably guess where I'm going. I can take 2 to the time derivative of that, grab the X component, and that's going to tell me what AX is as a function of rotation rate.
So you can just ignore the J direction?
Yeah, so that's what we're going to say. Hey, there's no motion in that J direction. Right? So I didn't really care about that. I know that all of that's going to balance out and be zero. Right? If you wanted to figure out what are actually are these reaction forces, or what are those reactions at the pin, then yeah, you have to solve that, and it turns out being a statics problem, more or less, right? All that stuff's equal to zero rather than some motion in that direction. Excuse me. So, I can obviously take the, write the total velocity of M2 as a function of time, and then I can, whoop, that's one dot, got an extra dot in there. I know the expression to describe the acceleration of M2 as a function of how fast it's spinning. Okay. So then if we look at this equation, I know this term, this I direction term, has to equal minus M, or fit into this equation at least. So we know then that M2 times that acceleration has to equal minus n. So then we can take this guy, show the negative of that, just plug it in there. Okay. So that tells us that's the case. And then we end up with an equation of motion that looks like this. Here we go. So now we've got to an equation that can tell us something about the oscillation of the main mass as a function of kind of how fast is smaller when it's spinning. And of course, the distance away, how far offset it is from the center matters, and how large M2 is. Does the rest of this equation make sense to you physically? Yeah, I mean, we see it's just a mass spring damper, basically, right? Total mass is M1 plus M2 in some way, right? That makes sense. This right-hand side, we see, well, if M2 is larger, the larger percentage of my mass is offset from the center, then I get a kind of higher amplitude oscillation, higher amplitude input, effectively. Well, that makes some sense, too, physically, right? The more unbalanced your rotating imbalance is, the more it's going to vibrate. Makes some sense. All right? Yeah, so you get size of the mass and how far it is away from center. Both contribute. We saw also that it depends on the square of how fast it's spinning. So what does that do for us as this omega goes down to zero? What's that frequency response start to look like? We've seen in all other our problems as omega, our input frequency goes to zero, we go to some constant value. Does that happen here? Yeah, as omega goes to zero, this whole thing goes to zero. But what does omega being zero mean for this system? It's not rotating. My rotating imbalance isn't rotating, so it doesn't excite any vibration. Well, that makes some sense. So we got to some equations that kind of match our intuition about how this system should behave, hopefully. Okay. So what I want to get to, however, is kind of the real math behind that frequency response, behind that intuition. If I want to get to, say, a transfer function for this, what do I need to do? Assume some kind of solution. Okay. That's what we've been doing so far. What kind of a solution should I assume here? Yeah, so I have damping, right? If you're thinking about this, right, this is just pure harmonic input. This happens to also be scaled by the square of the input, right? There's some coefficient. In this case, it's frequency dependent, but it's some coefficient times the pure harmonic. So going back to our basic mass spring damper solution, I have some damping, so I know I'm going to need both the sine and cosine parts, right, to account for the phase shift. What's the other way to solve that? Yeah, the complex version. Let's do that. So what we're going to assume, we're going to take this equation, and we're going to say, well, I'm going to assume for now that my rotating imbalance input is instead a complex exponential. I can just do that. What we'll remember, however, is that my real, both physically and mathematically, input is a cosine. So it's the real part of whatever we get out of the solution. Right? Okay. So if I have a complex exponential input, what should I assume my solution to be? Exponential. So let's assume, given we have a complex there, X time response of that mass matches the form of the input. And remember that this X bar can be complex itself. In fact, in general, it is. Okay. So if I take this guy, and what we need to solve for is X bar, right? So I take this, and I take two derivatives, plug in there, and then solve that resulting equation for X bar. Right. What we find the order I'm writing stuff in notes. Mix my forms. Hold on a second. Getting ahead of myself. I haven't done that yet. Sorry about that. Omega C. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So if you look at this, we can kind of get some intuition again about what's going to happen. Right. This kind of describes our frequency response. It's complex right now. Right. But we see as omega goes to infinity, or as omega goes to zero, what happens here? Goes to zero. Two I omega C. Okay. As omega goes out to infinity, what do you get to? That's the one we haven't talked through. Well, I have omega squared, right? So if as omega goes out to infinity, I end up with omega squared, right? Those omega squares dominate those terms, so that you can kind of ignore those guys, right? So I get to some constant value as this thing, the rate of rotation goes to infinity. That's a little bit different than we've seen before, too. Let's write this again. Let's try to look and think about it in our terms of natural frequency and damping ratio. It's a little bit more generalizable than trying to reason about what K and C are and where things happen there. How do I get to that kind of natural frequency and damping ratio version of this equation? Yeah, I'm going to divide by this kind of inertial term, which in this case includes both masses. So if I do that, I get where we see, okay, what's omega n going to be? Or omega n squared, maybe. K over m1 plus m2, right. Okay. What is 2 zeta omega n? It's just c over m1 plus m2. What's beta? Yeah, M2 over M2. If you look at that guy, that beta tells us something about kind of how much of the total mass is contained in the rotating. So that gives us some information about the severity of our rotating imbalance in some ways, right? That mass ratio. The higher beta is, the more problems you're going to have, basically. Okay. So then we can play the same trick we just did, right? We assume a solution and plug in. And in fact, that's kind of what I had gone to before. So we have E beta squared, omega squared, omega n squared minus omega squared, plus 2 zeta omega omega n times I. Okay. So then we know that x of t, right, is just x bar times e to the omega t. We plug in, and now we have a time domain representation of how x moves as a function of speed of that input, speed of rotation. Okay. Once we have that, what do we need to do to get back to the real, both physically and mathematically, solution? We take the magnitude and phase, that's right. Okay. So I'll save you the math and put that out. Go. So there you have the time response and magnitude and phase information describing the response of this general rotating imbalance. Okay. Of course, we could also normalize by frequency, right? Divide top and bottom by omega n squared, and you can get that normalized version like we've done for everything else too. Let's take a look at their frequency response of the system. So I'm going to plot it as normalized frequency. Okay. I'm also going to normalize the magnitude. Right. So what I'm going to write actually is this term, that magnitude of x bar, divided by E beta. So kind of normalizing, sorry, that's magnitude of X bar, which is that term. Okay. So, down at low frequency. You've already, yes, sir?
Should the square on the...
be inside the parentheses. Yes. Okay, so down at low frequencies, down at as omega goes to zero, what happens to the system? Let's start without damping. So if my damping is zero, zeta is zero. We already talked through that case. What happens? Omega goes to zero, my rotating imbalance is not rotating. Nothing's going to happen. What happens out at infinity? Goes to some constant? Okay. Where does it go? So I've got one vote for zero. I've got one vote for some constant. I think someone said one. Which is it? So we said right now, we're talking no damping, right? So you can ignore that piece, right? And then we say, well, omega goes going to infinity, right? We got the square root of omega to the fourth, omega squared, right? So we have E beta omega squared over omega squared. It's the limit of that in infinity. It's E beta, right? Right, so the limit of that term as omega goes to infinity when you don't have damping is E beta. Right. That's why we normalize by this guy, partially. So what that does is out at infinity, I'm going there. I have some kind of constant amplitude oscillation. And if we normalize in this way, you actually go to 1. If you haven't normalized, you go to E beta. When our normalized frequency is 1, what's going to happen? Yeah, you got no damping, right? So that term doesn't exist. Normalized frequency being 1 means omega equals omega n. You got something over 0. Goes out, that's infinity. So we're up to infinity. We don't have damping. Okay. Let's add a little damping. What changes? Peak's going to come down. It doesn't go to infinity any longer. Right? This term goes to 0, but we still got the damping to prevent it from going to infinity. Okay. What happens down at low frequency? As omega goes to 0. Still going to go to 0. My rotating balance is still not rotating. So I don't have any input, anything exciting the system, right? So it's still got 0 here, right? Going to some peak up here. What happens out of it as omega goes to infinity? It's still going to go to constant, still going to go to E beta, actually. So we go out to 1 over there still. So our response then something like that. And as usual, there's a pretty version of this in the notes. Okay. It's double damping. What changes? Yeah, the peak goes down. As we talked, it's going to shift a little bit to the left of the, right? How about at high and low frequency? Anything different there? No. So we still go to 0. Still no excitation if it's not rotating, right? Still going to a constant. So we end up with something like that, maybe. Do one more. Double it again. What changes? Peak, what happens to the peak? Now to the left. Something like that. So there we go. Frequency response for a rotating imbalance. Okay. At first glance here, what do you want to do with damping if you're trying to limit the magnitude of this oscillation? Yeah, increase it. So for this plot, increasing damping always results in lower amplitude oscillation. Okay. We talked about the problem, though, that, hey, this can come up where you have oscillation here that damages that machine, but it also can come up where you're damaging the floor, the fixturing for the system's on, right? And maybe transmit vibration down to other machines. Okay? What do you think? Does increasing damping always fix that problem? Why not?
Because it like decreases performance, like you said. And then...
So it decreases the amplitude of oscillation. Right. What matters in terms of me shaking the floor? Let me do this for you. Here's my floor. What forces are acting on the floor? Spring and damper, right? Actually, it's going to be up if we draw it like that. What happens if you increase damping? Yeah, FD is going up. Right? So often, it's not as simple as just crank up your damping. Because you could be, depending on where you're out in that curve, actually transmitting more force to the floor with less amplitude of oscillation here. Okay. So we'll talk more about that as we progress. So we need to pay attention more than just the magnitude. Right? Okay. Questions about that? Nobody? Okay, yeah.
Regardless if it's the input sine or cosine harmonic, could you use exponential like that?
Yes. So the question was, hey, if we worked this out and how we define our angles and stuff, this had been a sine. Or more generally, in the kind of general, right, this is just a pure harmonic input. Okay. Right? So had this been sine, could we have got to the same stuff effectively? Yes. Okay. You just have to remember that the sine would be the imaginary component of this, and then do your work accordingly. And you could, I mean, if you want, you could say, hey, let x of t be a cosine omega t plus b sine omega t, and do the math that way if you want. Well, what you'd have to do, the amplitude of that ends up being square root of a squared plus b squared, if you have this. So we can talk to that quickly, just to give you the... You could say, hey, I know it's... I could assume that here if I wanted to. Right? If I want to get into magnitude and phase form, the magnitude is square root of a squared plus b squared. Right? And then the phase is tan, in this case, inverse tan of A over B. Right? And you can look up that trig conversion on any table or textbook, right, if you don't remember it. If you wanted to get into magnitude and phase form. The math here, like just the strict math here, is going to be more annoying than dealing with the complex stuff, generally. Particularly as the complexity of the models we're dealing with increases. But like I said before, that's a decent exercise, probably, as you're working problems. Okay, I want to go from equation of motion to x of t. I want to do it once with complex form, do it once this way. See that you're going to get the same stuff. That's how you can start developing some real understanding rather than just plug in the method and go. Which is what we're trying to get to. Other questions? Yes, sir.
In your x bar equation, where is 2 and the 2i omega c?
This. 2 zeta omega. So when you take the two derivatives here, that 2, that guy gets plugged in there. And then the 2 ends up kind of carrying throughout. Yeah. Okay, we got a little bit of time left. Okay. So, for now, we're actually skipping 2.10. We're going to come back probably next week and talk about that in a lot more detail. Okay. We're moving on to other types of damping. So, we talked about viscous damping only, right? Linear viscous damping, where the force is proportional to the rate of change of the length of that damper, right? So, what we're going to talk about first, and primarily, friction. More specifically, dry friction. And even more specifically of that, kind of the Coulomb approximation of dry friction, which you can't call Coulomb damping. Okay. So let's look at our benchmark system. Just say there's a mass and a spring right now. But instead of a frictionless surface, now our surface, our interface between the mass and ground, has friction. Okay. And more specifically, we're going to say, hey, that has some kind of coefficient of friction, mu. And right now, we're not going to differentiate between static and kinetic friction. We're just think of it as one variable for right now. Okay. So I want to get the response of this mass. What I need to do? Free body diagram, even from the simple guy. I have the mass. Where are the forces? Spring force. Some kind of frictional force. I'll call FF. Some kind of gravity force. Some kind of normal force to keep it going through the ground. Okay. Anything else? That's it. What's next? We've got a coordinate system, I think. As we usually do for this simple guy, fix coordinate frame xy with I direction and small x makes sense. And we're defining, again, the position of our mass from that spring equilibrium length. So at x equals 0, the spring is at equilibrium. Okay. So let's talk. This is the only piece of that we haven't seen yet. The force of friction here?
The normal force times the constant.
Normal force times the constant. What constant? U. Okay, so I have the coefficient of friction. The normal force. I need one more piece of information. The direction. How does this friction force act? Opposite direction of motion. So I'm going to capture that by doing that. So this sine function, SGN, if x dot is positive, this is just 1. X dot is negative, this is minus 1. So it just gets the sine of whatever argument you're feeding to it. Okay. And note here that in this case, that is just x. Right? In the general case, it's the relative velocity of the two bodies on which friction is occurring. So in this case, if our ground was moving that way, we'd have to figure out what the relative velocity at that interface is. Okay. Furthermore, the book actually simplifies directly to what the answer is in this problem. I'm glad you came up with normal force. This is the general form of the magnitude of that friction force. Coefficient of friction times normal. Okay. It's not always just mg like it would be in this problem. Okay. The book jumps directly to mg. I think that's a little bit confusing. Right? Because that normal force can be greater than mg. In fact, in a lot of the interesting cases, at least, that it is. And often dynamics dependent. So, we have some kind of magnitude, some kind of sign information. Okay. How does this compare to our viscous damping? So let's plot, let's see. So if that had been a damper, what is its force? Cx dot in this case, right? If that had been a damper. Okay, so let's plot that guy. Just plot xd versus force. Okay. What's the linear viscous damper look like? We have x dot on horizontal. What's the force when x dot 0? How does the force change with x dot? Linear. It's a line passing through 0. Well, it was mx plus b, right? B is 0. So there's our damper. Viscous damping. That guy. Okay. Slope of that line is C. Okay. What's friction look like on this plot? Excuse me. X dot is positive. What does that tell us about the sign over here? It's just going to be 1. Okay. What's its magnitude? It's always just mu n. Okay. What happens at 0? What happens over here? Negative, right? The sign of this guy changed. X dot's negative. I get a minus 1 there. The magnitude of that force dry friction or Coulomb damping. Okay, so let's look at the effect. Yes, sir.
That equation is only true if you draw the friction force opposite of your standard direction.
Yeah, so yeah. So down here, so the question was, hey, what about this sign, effectively, right? Yeah, if we had drawn friction in the direction of motion here, then you have to have negative there. Right? So it's just kind of similar. So same thing with C. Right. So yeah, you're right in that the sign of this plot has to match what you have on your free body diagram. Right? And the way I've drawn this is just the magnitude of those turns. The actual direction would both be in the opposing motion. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at the effect this has on response. Okay, so if I'm going to write the equations of motion of this system, right? What are the sum of the forces? I actually have, those are both acting negative direction, right? And negative I. What about in the J direction? Normal. It's gravity. I could fill in some terms for what we know. Hopefully by now we would recognize that spring force is Kx. We just said that friction force is that. So there we have the sum of our forces acting on this mass. Right. And of course that is equal to total acceleration of that mass, which we know is that. Okay. Yes, sir.
Why is the friction force not acting opposite of the spring force?
They are both trying to force the system back to its equilibrium.
It's equilibrium. Imagining there's an applied force pulling it, so the spring would be pulling back on, and the friction force would be acting against that applied force.
That would be taken care of by this guy. So I will draw my direction of arrow, imagining a positive x dot.
Right.
All right. So then, okay, if I had a positive x dot, the friction is this way. So that's how I get to my direction of arrows when I draw free body diagrams. And then the relative, you're right, they're going to be out of phase actually, right? But that's taken care of with the sine phase because the position and velocity are exactly out of, or 90 degrees out of phase, right? Okay, so to figure out our motion in the I direction, which is really all the motion we have, right, I need to know what N is, that normal force, right? And, well, the J equation gives me that, right? In this particular very simple example, that normal force is just equal to mg. So then I can write the X direction equation like so. And we could pull the frictional force over on the left-hand side if we want. I left it on the right-hand side intentionally here. I think it's going to help us think about what the effect of that that force is on the response. Okay. Let's look at two cases. Okay. Let's look first at x dot greater than 0. What does this equation look like? What happens? X dot greater than 0, this guy is 1. So I end up with okay. X dot's less than 0. What does it look like? Yeah, so I have a negative sign there. Would cancel the negative sign on the force. I end up with that. So what we've seen here is really this, because the magnitude of this guy changes, it really is just this kind of piecewise linear response. Like, as long as x dot's greater than 0 and its sign is not changing, I have just a constant force acting on my system. And same thing here. As long as x dot's less than 0 and it hasn't changed yet, I have just a constant force acting on the system. So our response, if you're going to solve this by hand, that's how you have to solve it. You have to kind of monitor what x dot is. Right? When x dot switches sign, you switch over to this guy and solve it to the next time it switches sign. Right. So what you end up with time 6 of t. Let's look just at an initial condition response. So maybe I displace that mass over. So I go over to this guy and I pull him over to x naught and let go. So I'm going to have some oscillation. That phase of the problem. Okay. Where am I at in terms of which one of these applies? If that's position. Yeah, so I'm down here. Right. This is position, so the slope of this at every point, so right there, is the sine of this value, right? So in that whole range, I have this guy acting. Okay. I get and start going the other way, right? So think of this math as it's kind of extended. Well, I'll look back and it's starting to bounce back this way. Now I have positive velocity. So now I end up on this case. Right. So I have kind of switch there. And I have another kind of switch there. And that just repeats going through time. So the effect of that on the decay envelope, what we're going to see, I'll draw that in red maybe, what kind of decay do we have? What's the shape of that decay envelope if we have viscous damping? It's exponential, right? In this case, what we actually get, there's supposed to be a line. We end up a linear decay envelope when you have friction. And you should see that down here, too, if I can draw a straight line. Okay. Is the system guaranteed to settle to zero or toward zero? Okay, so we're toward zero. Is it guaranteed to settle at zero? No. Why not? Exactly right. So we can get to a place in this response, and we're not guaranteed it, and it's kind of a little bit hard to predict, actually, just sketching it like this. You can get to a place. You can imagine this thing vibrating back and forth, right? Well, you can get to a place if your friction coefficient is high enough where it sticks here, and the force of that spring pulling back on it, it's not enough to overcome that friction force any longer. Right. So we can get to, when we have friction in systems, we're not guaranteed to settle to actually zero, back to our equilibrium any longer. Okay. So that's the two, in terms of the responses, that's two of the main, in terms of vibratory responses, there's other effects. In terms of vibration, that's the two main changes. Right? We don't have an exponential decay any longer. It's a linear decay. And we're not guaranteed to stop at zero. Or to get to zero given an infinite amount of time. Right? And you're exactly right that it stops when that spring force is no longer strong enough to overcome friction. Okay. Make that note. Not guaranteed to go to zero. Yeah. No, you could. Yeah, you can stop at zero if things kind of balance out that way, right? Yeah, it'd be, yeah. Well, I don't know that's luck, but yeah, yeah. It's just a function of what these parameters all are. Okay, so we got a couple minutes left. Let's talk about this for a second. I have two options now to model damping in a system. Someone, your boss comes up to you and says, hey, model this thing, sets it on your desk. How do you choose?
Depending on the scenario.
Yeah, depending on the scenario, depending on what? What would drive you in one direction or the other? Yeah, I think you can have an equivalent of this, a rotational damping, a rotational friction, just like we could do for damping, right? And, yeah, the right answer is yeah, it depends. Right? It really turns out that if this friction is light enough, right, that this is actually not so bad a model for systems with friction, too. Okay? So that's often where you would probably want to start. Hey, I know there's friction in this thing, and there's something dissipating energy. Let me start with the kind of easiest form I know and see if that's going to be good enough to get me to the solution I need. And okay, that didn't get me the precision I needed for my calculations or my application. I know it's actually friction. Now, apparently, let's back off and see what the response looks like if I model it really as friction. Okay. So I think there's a huge amount of work. You know, we're seeing masses and springs and dampers. There's a huge quantity of work that's probably where you want to start to model it. All the crane research I've done, it's a mass and a pendulum. is our starting point for nearly all of that. And then we add complexity in as we need it for our particular application. And doing that lets you develop, hopefully, some intuition about that particular system. Whereas plugging into some kind of black box solver doesn't do that for you. Okay. Questions? Yes, sir. No. So friction in this case is a non-conservative force.
Yeah.
You have to consider it as such. Ends up being part of the generalized forces. Ends up being a Q. Yeah. Part of the Q. Part of the generalized forces. Yeah, that RD is kind of a hack based on knowing some stuff about viscous damping. I'll mention real quick before we take off, there's another type of damping mentioned in your book. We're not going to talk about it in detail. I'm not going to test you on it, but maybe take a brief look at that section called structural damping. That ends up being a pretty good, hang on guys, ends up being a better, arguably, approximation of energy dissipation in continuous bodies. So if you have a metal beam that's vibrating, it's a little bit higher fidelity model of that. And what you end up with is kind of a hysteresis here rather than a line or discontinuous function. So be aware of that. Know it's out there. I'm not going to ask you anything about it, though. All right. See you guys Thursday.